You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
After I hung up with Sarah Jaffe, who is the subject of this podcast, I sort of told her I was a little intimidated after reading the book, because it's not with the grief part, because we talk about that all the time, and her new book is called From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. But the revolution, I mean, she goes after a lot of political targets and a lot of the bad history in our country and elsewhere. But it ended up being a really great conversation. She's an independent journalist, and she covers the politics of power from the workplace to the streets. She wrote a book you might know, Work Won't Love You Back. And this new book, From the Ashes, is really terrific. So I think you're going to enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Sarah Jaffe, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I was interviewed last week by Scripps. They're doing a feature on the 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live. And since Second City has historically had, you know, fed so much talent to that show, they wanted to talk to me. So in particular, they wanted to talk about impersonations of political leaders. And I had to tell them that we don't really do that at Second City. The credo here, which I learned from the founders, is that all politics is personal. That we use the lens of our daily lives to explore how and why politics happens for better or worse. Your new book feels a little like that.
Often for worse. I mean, I, you know, it's funny, right? Because I'm talking to you and you are in the comedy industry. And like, normally the way I've done press for previous books is I make a lot of jokes, and it's really hard to make a lot of jokes when you've written a book about grief that is just kind of, it's rough. Yeah. There's a lot in here. And so it's like, well, Yeah, and this absolutely is about how politics is personal and how that personal hurt can both get people to take action, also make people feel like action is fruitless. The distance, I guess, between those two poles, and how we get unstuck from that space.
So the listeners to my podcast know my grief story. Can you sort of tell us how you come to this conversation in this book?
Yeah, so 6 years ago, my father died. And it was, as I say in the book, it was sort of, you know, ordinary. I mean, he was in his early 70s. He could have lived longer, but he had been unwell for a year before he passed, and sort of off and on for most of my adult life, right? He was a lifelong smoker. He worked too much. And I was completely unprepared for how much it upended my life.
Yeah.
And just, I read about this too, that like, I sort of thought that I'll be prepared for this, and I'll do a lot of reading, and I'll go back to therapy, and I'll be good at grieving, right? I can sort of power through it, and I will know how to do this. And oh, you cannot get an A in grief.
No,
that is not a thing at all. And so the amount to which it threw me for a loop, and then it ended up, because of that, I ended up leaving, you know, basically a marriage. And yeah, my life is completely turned upside down. And because of that, I'm a journalist, and I started seeing grief in everything that I was writing about and reporting on. And this was, you know, this would have been 2018. I had written a lot about the movement for Black Lives. I have written a lot about immigration and, you know, mostly a labor journalist. So obviously I had written a lot about deindustrialization and had particularly been thinking about that one in the Trump era because it had become such a cornerstone of that discussion around like, why did Trump win? Then of course, 2020 comes along, COVID happens, and then there's another round of uprisings around the country that make the other ones look, you know, small. And then of course, overarching over all of this is the specter of climate change. And so it was like, oh, okay, there's a book in this. And the uncomfortable thing about it, of course, that most people are asking me to start out by telling my grief story is that I do end up telling my story in the book, which is a sort of no-no of a lot of journalism, right? You're supposed to be objective. You're supposed to keep yourself out of it. But for me, I really found that I couldn't sort of go around asking people their grief story without sharing mine, you know, and this is in fact, like, you know, you shared yours with me before we got on this call, before we hit record on this call. And as you said, your listeners know it well. And so, yeah, it is something that I felt I had to put in this book, even though it makes me deeply uncomfortable to talk about it. Still, I felt like I couldn't ask people to let me share their stories without being willing to sort of put mine out there first.
Yeah, I think I wish a book like this had existed earlier for me, and other reading that I ended up doing, which was great. But you know, it's grief is not linear.
Yeah.
It lives in the body in a way that I like. Of course, people in our culture understand mind body.
Yeah,
I didn't understand it in that way.
No, not at all. Not at all. And, you know, I was really lucky. I had a friend who was at the time when my father died, studying to be a death doula. And she literally had like a worksheet that she sent to me and was like this, you know, and one of the things it had on it was like, here are physical things that might happen to you. And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm not dying. I'm not like, you know, this is not my dad's heart disease showing up in me. It's just my body reacting to losing him. That's what's happening. And yeah, without her, without that knowledge, because it really wasn't something that had come up in any reading that I had done, the way that like, I can't breathe, you know, or that my heart is racing and I wake up in the middle of the night, like sweating and my heart pounding, that like, I actually remember it was because it was like 6 months later that food first tasted good again.
Yeah.
You know, because I was in Italy and I was, you know, I just said yes to all of the work. Spoiler alert for Yes And, right? I'm freelance. I had to make money, but also like I didn't have any like volition to like pitch stories. So just editors would reach out to me. People would be like, oh, do you want to come do this thing? And I'd be like, sure, yes. Whatever, I will do the thing because I need to keep moving forward, even though it feels like the world has stopped. And, you know, it, being in Italy, it was like, okay, if like Italian food in Bologna did not taste good, it would have been
There's no use
that moment, right?
Around.
Yeah, but it's that moment of just being like, oh, I remember what like pleasure feels like again.
I'm a sucker for like an excellent term that I haven't heard before. One recently, someone told me about chaos entrepreneurs. Isn't that great?
I like that. I like that.
So you have a few that I want to talk to you about and get. And some are grief related, and some are we'll talk about later with regard to sort of socioeconomic or political that sort of thing. Disenfranchised grief.
Yeah. That was one too that really, when I stumbled upon that, it was like, oh. And, you know, one of the things that I did to report this book, because I figure like I'm not ever going to be able to become an expert in like clinical studies of grief, right? Like, you know, scientific studies of grief. So I interviewed a series of psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, different people who had worked with people who were grieving at different times. And that was one that came up in several of those conversations, was this idea that like, and Mary Grace DeMaria, who is one of those people, I think the way she described it was, you know, she was talking about like the opioid epidemic, right? Mm-hmm. And people who lose someone to opioids, it is really hard to talk about that in public because there's a lot of shame, because there's a lot of judgment that comes with drugs, right? That you were using a substance and therefore you were weak, you were bad, you were something, something, whatever. And therefore they sort of brought their death upon themselves. And that lack of recognition for your grief, that lack of ability to sort of bring it into the public, makes it this sort of disenfranchised thing. We can't talk about it. But then, like, as we were talking about before we hit record, sort of everybody's grief is disenfranchised in this culture because really just don't talk about it at all. So even if you have the kind of story that is sort of normal, again, like mine, it's like, well, we expect if it's normal, you just sort of put it away. And it's like, well, yes, everybody's parents will die eventually. Get back to work, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have like a unique story and a real tragedy, there are often just these ways of blaming people for their own death. So, you know, one of the sections of the book is about state violence, and it's particularly, again, about people who are killed by police. And like, there are just always stories about how they must have deserved it, right?
Yeah.
And what this person did to deserve it. So therefore you don't get to grieve and your grief doesn't get to be sort of publicly validated. And that's one of the things that has been so powerful about that movement, right? Is insisting on grieving in public and saying, when we say Black Lives Matter, right? When you say his name, say Tyre Nichols, Darius Stewart, right? It is an insistence on that grief and of making that grief everyone's problem.
I remember after Nora died, my wife Anne said to me one day, she's like, now I understand mourning clothes.
Mm-hmm.
This wish that, and then those would get worn for a year. And there was different, and then I did the little study on it, and there's different gradations of colors to kind of give indications. But it was a way of signaling to the world to be soft with me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh, why'd we get rid of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, right? Like I was so fascinated by this period of history where like grief was very public. I read a wonderful book about the spiritualism movement, you know, and this period of like widespread public belief that you could talk to the dead and that the dead usually talked through women, right? Which was fascinating part of it. And and that is so foreclosed now. We don't do mourning clothes. Like people still wear black to a funeral, but after that, you know, I mean, also I'm often wearing black. I'm an old goth and I lived in New York for 14 years. So like wearing black all the time wouldn't really signal anything to most people. But like there's so little now that we can do to ask the world to be soft with us.
It's an interesting quote from the book that you say, quote, if we can find the role we play in the process, we can turn collective mourning into revolt.
Yeah.
That's a turn that one would normally expect. Yeah. So what's the fuel? I mean, I think I know what the fuel is, but how'd you put it together?
Yeah, I think again, talking about the movement for Black Lives, talking about particularly the 2020 uprisings, right? Because on the one hand, it was sparked by the death of one man, of George Floyd in Minneapolis, right? And on another hand, it was during a pandemic where so many people were dying, and disproportionately the people who are dying are Black and Brown working class people who had to sort of keep going out and going to work in much more dangerous conditions. And it was sparked by, you know, any number of other awful things that people have experienced in their lives. And that people were able to connect those dots and say, like, I do have a role in this. Yeah. It's not just for people who knew George Floyd, and it's not just for Black people, and it's not just for people in Minnesota, and it's not just for people who had someone die of COVID, but it's actually for all of us who just feel this sort of worsening of our life circumstances in 1,000 different ways. And that is worth grieving. And it's also worth like making some demands around. And the feeling that you have nothing left to lose it's a terrifying, terrifying one, but it's also like, it is weirdly powerful. you know, you could be like, okay, well, you know what? Like the worst has happened. So what are you going to throw at me?
Yeah. It's also gendered, right? Yeah. I mean, because that's it. You talked about the spiritualists.
Yeah.
We know the caregiving community, largely
right,
women.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then all the, these campaigns for justice are so often, you know,
so often led by women. Yeah. Yeah. And mothers, sisters, cousins, aunts, daughters, Erica Garner, right? Like we, and it's interesting too, because I'm thinking of Vicky Osterweil's book on In Defense of Looting, where she makes a comment about like riots being femme, which I thought was great because it's just this inversion of the idea that like, you know, that the big disruptive action is like masculine action. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, I don't think that that's true, because I think it's also big disruptive action is it necessitates sort of coming together, and women are the ones who have been tasked with bringing people together and holding communities together for most of, you know, most of the world's history and most of the world's places. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of, you know, it is work to do the work of organizing. All of those things are labor, but then there's something in the moment of uprising that does feel like the opposite of work. And I write about, and this is where people who know my work and think she's a labor journalist, what's she doing with all of this? Is like, I sort of insist that grief is not work. Again, I couldn't study at it and get an A in it. I couldn't be good at it.
Yeah.
That it was impossible to work at it, but also that it was sort of, it contained within it something that's kind of fundamentally anti-work. The same way that those big rebellions have something in them that is fundamentally anti-work. It is anti the need for us to go back, get back to the job, you know. It is saying no to all of that and saying, like, actually what we need time for is like everything else that makes us human.
One of my favorite recent podcasts we had was with Christopher Wong Michelson and Jennifer mm-hmm. Tatsi Karas, who have a book called Is Your Work Worth It? Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm connecting here, because he's a philosopher, she's an organizational psychologist.
Yeah.
But they looked at the New York Times after 9/11, and they had done all the profiles of the people who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
They were all at work.
Right, right.
And they weren't writing the pieces were written by other people,
right.
And the studies that they sort of looked at were, and this was really, I don't know, it was powerfully moving for me, was the idea of one of the reasons work is so important to us is for our loved ones. We mm-hmm. want them to look at our work a certain way, and that's how we get, and we're seen through these other eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I never thought about my work, and then I'm like, it made perfect sense once I thought about it, but that's not a conversation that we have.
Well, I mean, obviously my previous book was called Work Won't Love You Back, so can relate. You know, and particularly what I was getting at in that book was even these jobs that we're supposed to love, right? You have been working in comedy and entertainment and for you know,
decades.
A long time. Yeah, I've been working in journalism and I'm writing books for a living and I get to go out and talk about those books and this is my job, which is cool, right? But it still takes a lot out of you and it's still like exhausting and often like, especially in those jobs that you're supposed to love, you have to sort of keep up the appearance of loving it even when you don't. And it is for, you know, the people around us as much as for ourselves. But then of course, you know, there's the, again, the sort of deathbed story of like, what do you wish you'd done more of? And like, it's so rarely like, well, wish I'd been.
More work.
Yeah.
More overtime.
Right. And that's obviously true when we think about like being a coal miner or being an auto worker. And these are some of the people who are in the grief book and From the Ashes. Those are the kinds of jobs that like, we expect you want to do less of, but the turn of sort of neoliberalism, right, has been towards these jobs where we have to be emotionally invested in it as well as physically there. And that is actually just a way that it can really take over your life. And so for me, you know, I wrote a whole book called Work Won't Love You Back. And then I've, you know, broken myself writing a book about grief. And I do what I say, not what I do. And, you know, there's like, even after all of this, I've sort of sat down and gone like, wow, I wish I'd like taken more time and given myself more like patience and grace in writing this book about grief, because wow, it was hard on me.
I would literally just had this conversation outside my office door.
Yeah.
My colleague had worked in Vegas just after one of his daughters was born.
Yeah.
And it was like a 2-year thing. And he's like, I missed 2 years. And I will not do that again. And I regret having done that. And then I sort of said to him, like, this is interesting because, you know, I stepped down from running Second City in 2016. I'd written Yes And book and been successful. And they kind of allowed me this grace period to figure out what I was going to do. And it was just beautiful because it was like, I really didn't have to do anything for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I got to see every game that Nora was in.
Yeah.
And we drove together to stuff and we drove afterwards and there was tears when they'd lose a volleyball game, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I got this incredible amount of time and space.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both with her, but then to figure out what I wanted to do.
Right.
And then I got this new thing where I get to read books and talk to cool people like you and then go speak to companies and make money for the company and to take care, you know, it's like, and that I recognize that those kinds of second acts don't come for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So accounting for my privilege. But also that shouldn't be rare.
Yeah, well, exactly, right? Like and it's so funny, right? Because, you know, we've got AI coming and there's a tweet that I can never remember how to paraphrase, but like somebody just perfectly said this. They were like, I thought the robots were going to like clean the toilets so I could write the poetry rather than the robots are going to write the poetry while I have to keep cleaning the toilets, you know? And it's like, right, like they're literally coming for the jobs that people want to do.
Yeah.
You know, and this is like why, you know, the Hollywood writer's strike was such a big deal, because they really took this on and said, like, look, like we love these jobs. We want these jobs. And not only do the people who do them love them, but like, I don't want to watch a movie that's been written by a computer. The computer doesn't know what's going to make me cry. Like, no computer can make. Oh, I was just talking about this movie today, Before Sunset, which is one of my absolute favorite things.
Great
and
one.
It just wrecks me every time. And like, there is no way that an AI can ever figure that out and figure out how to feel. And actually, I'll just go ahead and say it, my ex, who I write about in this book, who we are very good friends once again, sent me this Guardian article the other day that's called Back from the Dead, Could AI End Grief? Just to bring us back to the main thing. No. And it is this guy. Okay, I'm going to read you the like blurb of it.
Yeah, please.
Video. Tech entrepreneur Justin Harrison is on a mission to fundamentally change how we experience loss.
I hate him.
Using artificial intelligence to recreate the essence of dead loved ones from their digital footprint. His company, You Only Virtual, is part of a growing worldwide grief tech industry, harnessing AI to attempt to replace what has naturally departed.
I can't.
My dude, people are people.
Yeah.
Look,
tons of people, I get interviewed all the time about this because they're like, well, how is AI going to affect the comedy industry? I'm like, robots aren't funny.
Robots
they don't know
funny.
How to improvise. And the part they don't, because it's the upsetting of the pattern that is where comedy comes from. It is that it is that surprise and it's the minute detail that none of us really paid attention to that was sitting there the whole time. And my wife is actually she runs a major, the first ever major in comedy.
Amazing.
Tenured professor of comedy.
Fabulous. I love that.
And one of the, in all the comedy theory books, no one ever brings up one aspect of comedy, aspect that we know at Second City is funny, which is simple recognition. So if you have a character that you see on a park bench in the first act and he comes back and does something in the second act, people will laugh simply because they recognize it.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's no, that's not a pun. That's not benign violation. That is a simple thing of what humans do is they recognize things and they recognize them as kind of true in a way. And it's funny. But it's not, no algorithm is going to be able to capture that.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about my industry.
Right.
And ultimately I'm actually not worried about other artists in terms of that. Yeah. We want good content.
Right. Right. The problem is we're not getting what we want in the world, you know, that's the real problem, right? Is that like, we are not, you know, the shows that I love keep getting canceled on Netflix.
But there's a lot of good shows. I mean, this is a weird thing right now.
Weird time. Yeah.
Which is I can't keep up. I never watched The Sopranos.
Really?
No.
Okay.
I watched The Wire. Like
The Sopranos watched, better.
Okay. Homicide, Life on the Street. Fucking loved it.
Yeah.
So I could go watch The Sopranos and I know I would be blown away.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Slow Horses is mine right now. If I'm going
I haven't watched that one yet. I've heard it's good though.
Right. So there, and this is it's neoliberalism. It's the commercial stuff that's coming in because and then they're, you know, and the industry doesn't know how to react. And now suddenly we're back in weird cable days where it's like we have to buy a million things. And it's like it will figure itself out. I think the AI will too, because it's not like we don't go through this with every new technology.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Well, and there are signs already. I read the Financial Times in the morning because I like to go where capitalism is honest with itself. And and then, you know, some of these investors are like already warning that like we have pumped a lot of money into this thing and we do not actually know how it's going to make money. Certainly how it's going to make money that exceeds the costs of doing it because of the amount of computing power you have to throw at it. Right.
Oh, terrible for the environment.
Right. But to think back to like this dude who is like, we can make a virtual you and that will like substitute for grief. And it's like, this is like the whole problem, right? Is that that like people are not fungible. You can't like just swap in a new person or like a fake version of the old person. You know, we were talking about dogs dying earlier too. And like, so Javier Milei, the Chilean president, right, reportedly has several dogs that are clones of his old dog. And
really?
Yes. And this is that part is true. The part that I do not know if it is true, but I choose to believe it because it's hilarious, is that they all hate him. And I it's funny because like Milei is a weirdo, but also it's funny because like, even cloning your dog doesn't guarantee you're going to get the same like affection from the cloned dog as you got from the old one. Right. That is such a, you know, thing. And that's like to go back to my book, right. That like one of the points that I'm making in this thing is that we are, you know, in the system where so many cogs to be plugged in, right? And this is why the, you know, the AI people think that they can just replace us all with robots, because like so many jobs are de-skilled down to the point where you just need sort of a live body to do the thing, right? Whether it be, you know, flipping burgers at McDonald's or putting together a car or writing content according to SEO terms, right? Like there are so many things that have been deliberately stripped down to the basics in order for them to be able to be done by whomever so that you can keep your labor costs down. And like, right, I'm not worried about me being replaced by AI because AI can't write my next book. It can rewrite my last book, but that one's already been written. So, but what I'm worried about is like young people who are trying to come up in the industry who now are, you know, going to be like, are never going to get a chance to write because their job is just going to be to like give a quick read over to the thing that the ChatGPT wrote so they can slap it up, you know, according to whatever five SEO words are trending that day. That's the challenge. It's like, you know, I am fairly knock on my desk is not actually made of wood. I'm fairly like, I have created a product out of myself, right? I have successfully commodified the thing that I do in a way that it is hard to replace unless my next few books are all flops, in which case I'm screwed. But like, how do you get into this work now? That's the challenge, because the drive of capitalism has always been to kind of like turn us into fungible cogs in a machine where, and like grieving is so specific that I think it is really sort of fundamentally counter to that tendency.
Can we go back to the dog thing really quick?
Yeah.
So I haven't talked about this in the podcast, but we lost Benchley, our Bernese Mountain Dog, a week ago. He was nine and a half, which is older for a burner.
Yeah.
But was so sad, like for us. And now that we're empty nesters, our son's in Atlanta, Nora's gone. It was like the house is just. And I remarked on this to Anne. I said, you know, so it was so inconvenient. So he's giant. You're stepping over him. There's constant tumbleweeds of hair. There's the baby gate so he doesn't go up the stairs. There's all sorts of stuff. And then I'm like, I miss the inconvenience.
Yeah.
And it was such a reminder of like, oh, because anything that's worth it is hard.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I miss vacuuming up the dog hair. Incidentally, he's the president of Argentina, not Chile. Okay. So I said that wrong. So we sub that in with Javier Milei,
who's the sideburns guy. It's the guy with the weird sideburns.
Yes. He's the president of Argentina. But that thing, like the difficulty is the thing, right?
Because your relationship with your dad wasn't like, it was complicated.
It was quite bad in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think that was, you know, that was one of the things that was hard for my ex to sort of wrap his head around, because he hadn't lost a parent at that point. He was like, you weren't close. And I'm like, yeah, that's in some ways that like makes it harder when you lose them, right? Because I'm like, now I don't ever get to have the good relationship that I wanted to have with him. We don't get to resolve any of the conflicts we had. They're just gone, and I am never going to win that argument, or you know, I'm never going to apologize, or whatever it might be, you know. And again, I was lucky, and then I got to go down to South Carolina where he lived, and I got to be there, you know, for the last few days. But yeah, like that, the conflicts and the challenges and the ambivalence of it all were really some of the things that just made it so hard.
When your family doesn't do grief well. I mean, the
no, they don't.
The lack of attending funerals was shocking to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, again, like this is both a cultural thing in this world, and also like a very specific one in my family, which is like, oh, we don't know how to talk about difficult feelings, and specifically grieving, we really don't do that one well. And so yeah, and I think, again, this is one of the reasons that made me sort of feel like I had to write about this, was like, it is just like this like veil of silence over the whole subject in my family. And so nobody prepared me for it. Not that I think you can ever really be prepared for it, but you know, you can just have people who sort of accompany you through it once you're there. But nobody was there to do that. You know, nobody who was related to me was there to do that. It was really, you know, friends. And thankfully I have some really wonderful ones who really showed up and, you know, were with me through it.
There's a juxtaposition you draw between the billionaires and millionaires who died in that tourist submersible, mm-hmm. and the migrants who drowned in the Adriana. And it's really striking. So can you talk a little bit about that story from the book, and then the German ship captain?
Yeah. Yes, Carola. While I was working on the book last, I sort of did the research over a couple of years, and then I sort of sat down and wrote it all in a 3-month stint of madness that I will never do again like that, in the summer of 2023. And one of the big stories, I was in London, one of the big stories in at least in circles that I pay attention to was this ship that had been, was like a, you know, made over fishing boat where people had been crammed into a hold that normally held fish who were trying to get to Europe. And it sank off the coast of Greece. And there were questions about the Greek Coast Guard not getting there fast enough, or even some people on the boat accused the Coast Guard ship of helping them sink. And they rescued only like 100 and something or 200 people from it, and the rest of them died. And this was happening at about the same time as these guys in the submersible go down to visit the Titanic, and that gets vaporized. She's actually been in the news again, like the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it just was. They found
about it again.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and look, like, I'm not saying gleefully that all billionaires should be vaporized in a submersible, but like, the attention, and not only the attention like in the news, but the effort that was put in to find these 5 rich people in this thing that, like, when you watch the videos of it, it was like, oh my God, this thing was obviously like, they're controlling it with like a, you know, video game controller.
Yes. Yeah.
Of some sort. I don't play enough video games to know what kind, but you know. And yeah, and that distinction, and it was even more striking, I think, because one of the guys in the submersible is a really rich man from Pakistan. And meanwhile, many of the migrants on the ship are from Pakistan. And it just like highlights these inequalities within societies as well as between them, right? Between both Global South and Global North, and people are trying to come to Europe to be safer. And also, like, for some people in Pakistan, life is just fine.
Yeah.
That there are these internal inequalities too, that we're, you know, we're just seeing all of this sort of very spectacularly displayed, and like, who is grievable. And of course, it was even more striking that these guys were going down to see the Titanic, right? Because the famous story of the Titanic is that, like, the rich guys got the lifeboats and the poor people went down with the ship. And, you know, and that story, it was just like, it was all so on the nose that I almost didn't put it in the book, because I was like, it's all so on the nose. But well, also, I figure by the time the book comes out, it will not be the thing that everyone's talking about.
Right.
And particularly an American audience probably didn't hear about this.
Well,
people on this boat, right? That went.
And not that, is it Carola? Is that
Carola? Yeah, Carola Rackete. She's actually a member of the European Parliament. Let me look that up.
Oh, now she has. They tried to prosecute her for saving people.
Yeah, she's a member of the European Parliament from Germany now. So she's a ship captain. And one of several people who, you know, was doing rescue missions and trying to save people who were crossing to Europe on small boats, and had picked up some people and was off the coast of Italy. And this was, you know, when Matteo Salvini had just gotten into power and was, you know, flexing his muscle by talking about, you know, let everyone drown, basically. And and she was just like, this is unconscionable. Again, among other things, it's against international law, although of course, like, international laws these days. But, you know, and she was saying, like, right, like, these laws are not worth the paper they're printed on anymore. And a few of us are trying sort of hand over hand to, like, maintain some sense of humanitarianism again, to keep obeying what is, again, still technically the law. But it's triage, right? Because, like, the disasters people are fleeing keep happening with our tax dollars. And then people will keep coming, not because, like, being in Europe is so great for them or being in the US is so great for them, but because, like, what choice do you have? And, you know, talking about Argentina, but talking about, you know, Latin America and the role that the US has played in Latin America, and, like, why do people keep coming to our border? I don't know. Could we stop wrecking their countries?
Yeah.
Could we stop cooing the people that they've, you know, democratically elected, who want to do things like distribute the resources fairly from their natural resources?
We're so good at it.
We're really good at it. One of the episodes I was listening to, actually, you were joking about everything being Milton Friedman's fault. So that's another thing we can talk about.
It's always Milton Friedman's fault.
The Chicago voice, you know? And,
oh my God. I want to read this quote you have from her where she said, "You can't scare people into staying at home when their lives were already at risk there."
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Simple psychology. Simple reality. Like,
it's just, no number of sort of barrels with razor wire in the Rio Grande is going to keep people at home when, like, they're already under threat at home.
Yeah.
I quote the Warsan Shire poem about, like, you know, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. Like, that sense, and this was really what I wanted to capture in putting this in a book about grief, not only that we sort of render entire countries worth of people, vulnerable to death and ungrievable, but also that, like, people leave things behind that they would have rather kept.
Yeah.
You know, Idris, who is this young man that I spoke to, who is from Iraqi Kurdistan, he wanted to stay. He didn't want to, like, trek across Europe to a refugee camp in Turkey and then go to England by himself. He wanted to stay and play football and have his family around him. And he couldn't do that because we invaded Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, and use the Kurds as an excuse for invading Iraq. And then once he gets there, they treat him like he's a terrorist. And he's like, "No, man, I'm running from the same people you're talking about, you know, is the enemy." But, you know, right, he would have stayed. Mohammed Mira, who's now he drives for Uber. I first met him when he was working at Amazon in Minnesota. His family went back to Somalia recently, right? And that was one of those surprising things that comes at the end of interviews when I was just like, you know, so how are things? And he's like, oh, I'm just back from visiting my family for the first time since I left Somalia. And my wife and my children, and he always says my beautiful wife, which I love about him. And his wife and his children are there, and that he's working, he's living alone in the US and he's working for Uber in order to be able to pay for them to go to school in Somalia and to live in, you know, and yeah. And like, can go read the book Dirty Wars if you want to know all about what the US has done to Somalia. But like, it's not like he was like, oh yeah, we really want to live in Minnesota. It was, this is where you can be safe and this is where you can make money. And given the chance, his family wanted to go back. Mm-hmm. We don't think of it that way because we're told that obviously people want to come to America because it's so amazing here. Obviously people want to get to Europe because it's so amazing. And like, what are people leaving behind that they wish they could have kept actually?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we get to that, when 9/11 happened, second time we brought it up, my son, I think he was like 4 or 5. And I don't know if you remember this, but that was at the time when there were like shark attacks going on. So my son carried with him forever that somehow the shark attacks were related to the Twin Towers going down.
This okay.
A thing he had mixed up in his brain.
Yeah.
He's got it now. You wrote this book the summer the orcas started to attack.
Yes.
That's my connection.
Yes. I mean, again, these were things that were happening that like everybody was talking about at the time. And I was almost like, is it too on the nose to put them in there? And then I was like, you know what? Everybody loves the orcas. Mm-hmm. And I was so struck by a few pieces. I mean, Alexis Pauline Gums wrote this beautiful piece, I think in The Atlantic that I cite in the book about like, why wouldn't the orcas be pissed at us, you know? Mm-hmm. But also that orcas grieve, right? That there are these documented studies of a particular orca mother who's, you know, her baby died and she carried it for like weeks or months and just, you know, was great. It's like, this is, we are not the only beings that grieve, right? And in talking about climate change, right? We're sort of always talking about the future, but like there are a lot of people and a lot of other living creatures that have already lived through the disasters and are living through the disasters every day. And so, it kind of felt like, and again, I had that sort of lower in the chapter and my editor actually grabbed it and was like, I want to put this at the beginning of the chapter. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, when we sort of move through the book and I'm moving from sort of grieving an individual person to grieving a home, to grieving a job, to grieving society, and then to like the whole world. And so in that, I did want to get to more than human life, as a lot of people are beginning to call it. And so talking about the orcas, was a way to sort of open the door to like, I mean, yeah, we shouldn't anthropomorphize them on one hand, but on the other hand, like, we don't understand how their brains work and we don't understand how much they understand. And so if they grieve, if they coordinate hunting, if they can pass on this behavior of, you know, learning how to sink ships, or yachts anyway, not like full on ships, although I'm not a nautical expert, so I'm probably getting all of those terms wrong. Yeah. If they can pass that on, like what else are they passing on? And so I thought it was really, it was a way into just talking about the fact that like, it's not just us on this planet and we're boiling it for, you know, everything that lives on it.
That's right. That all of it is happening at the same time. And you know, we can allow ourselves to be distracted and sometimes that distraction is necessary. But you know, all of it is happening. And it is a thing I talk about in terms of my, you know, what I do here, which is to constantly remind people that, you know, our humanity doesn't just stop the minute we walk into an office.
Right.
That like the greatest work environments I've been in is where philosophy and art and music and all those things are happening. And, you know, and I'm very lucky that when my dog died, the first person to call me was the CEO of the company and said, I'm sorry I'm bothering you on a weekend, but I just want to make sure you're okay.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And then the COO sent me flowers. You know, it's just like, oh, okay, that's where I work. And then everyone checked in on me when I got to work the next week.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and that was the appropriate thing to do. And still, like, how are you doing? You okay? And that is not normal. I know that.
No, and that's the thing, right? Is that like it's on the one hand, it's like the bare minimum. And on the other hand, like it's so rare.
Yeah, right. That's the problem. All right. Do you have a yes and story for us to end the podcast on?
Yeah, I feel like journalism is full of yes and stories, right? And I was almost telling one of those stories with Mohammed, because I, you know, we were at the end of this phone call and then he mentioned that his wife and kids had gone back. But there's another one in the book that that we didn't talk about. So I want to talk about Kevin. So Kevin Horn was a miner in Britain, and he was involved in the miner strike in the 1980s. And we were talking for like 2 hours along with Kate Flannery, who is this amazing activist who's also in the book in this chapter on deindustrialization. And at the end, you know, and I'm just like, I had turned the recorder off and we're just chit chatting and Kate had gone. And I was like, so what did you do when the mines closed? And he goes, oh, I went into care work. And I was like, oh, and you know, and it just opens up this whole other world. And we had this whole other conversation that ends up shaping that chapter in such an interesting way, because it was this whole like, right, what skills did you have as a miner that actually made you really good at being a care worker, that most people think, again, that that's work for women? And how did this like big, strong, tall guy who had been, you know, digging coal out of the ground actually turn around and use so many of the same skills and a bunch of ones he never knew he had to do caring work? So that's one of my favorite sort of, you know, at the end of this conversation, a whole new world like opens up in front of you.
I love it. The book is called From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. Sarah, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.